The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 2.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome, everyone. Today's guest is Carlos Lara, and I picked him primarily because he is the co-host with me on The Lara Murphy Show, which many of you no doubt listen to. And if you don't, you really ought to. And so since I had Tom Woods as the guest on episode number one, I realized, well, I got to have Carlos on as the guest for episode number two. So this, just to let you know, is going to be a lengthy conversation. But if you have time to just sit down and just listen to it, I think you'll really enjoy it. So Carlos and I, we start with pleasantries, but I promise you by the end we get into some really deep issues. I certainly had a lot of fun talking to him. Certainly if you know Carlos through my work with him in other venues, then I think you'll enjoy this particular conversation we had because we get into stuff that we normally don't talk about. So Carlos's official background, he is the CEO of United Services and Trust Corporation, a consulting firm specializing in business advisory services for privately held corporations. But I know him because he's the one who introduced me to the infinite banking concept, IBC, and we'll be talking about that a little bit in the interview. He is the co-author with me of two books. One is called How Privatized Banking Really Works, and that's where we try to integrate Austrian economics and the infinite banking concept. And then along with Nelson Nash, we also are all co-authors of the book called The Case for IBC, and that's actually got its own website called thecaseforibc.com. Carlos is also, as I mentioned, the co-host with me of The Lara Murphy Show, a podcast devoted to Austrian economics and IBC. We talk about financial issues there from that perspective. You can see that all these things are available at laramurphy.com. So that's laramurphy.com. And to round this out, let me just mention, Carlos said that if I want to get into some of the biographical details, he's been married to his wife, Anne, now for 48 years. He has three children and five grandchildren. He is a Christian and a member of Westminster Chapel, a Reformed evangelical congregation in Nashville, Tennessee. And so with that introduction, here we go with my conversation with Carlos Lara. Well, hello, Carlos. Glad to have you here on the second episode of The Bob Murphy Show. How are you doing?
I'm good, Bob. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, sure thing. And, you know, it just was fitting that it made sense that Tom was going to be the first person since he kind of got me into podcasting. And we have a big audience that listens to Contra Krugman, who I'm sure is going to come over. And I realized, well, geez, I also do this podcast with Carlos, so bring him over. And what I want to do, though, just to make sure the listeners understand, I want to talk about things that we don't normally come up. So, yes, perhaps later in this conversation, we'll get into the infinite banking concept, IBC, which is the sort of the business thing that Carlos and I work on. But before we get into that stuff, I just want to have a conversation about some of the more interesting personal aspects of his life, just so people get to know him better. So if we can start out, Carlos, I love the story you told me once when you were like a little kid. So first of all, if you want to tell the listeners about, you know, where you were born, because you grew up in Mexico, right? And then at what point did you come to the United States?
I was actually 6 years old when I came to the United States. So, yes, I grew up in Monterrey, Mexico, which is it's the third largest city in Mexico. It's closer to the, you know, Texas border there around in there. But so it's more central Mexico. But, yeah, that's where I was born.
So can I ask you, it just occurred to me, I don't think I've ever asked you this. Do you remember that well? Like that period, like, do you remember being told, oh, we're going to the United States, or is that all a haze to you?
Oh, no, I remember it very well. It's amazing what you can, you know, you're pretty much aware when you're 6 years old. I knew that that was going to occur, and my family on my father's side of the family was very upset about, you know, my family coming to the United States. They didn't want that at all. Now, on my mother's side of the family, they actually were looking forward to it because she already had several brothers and sisters that had already come to the United States. And so, and her own mother had actually moved to the United States. So she was like the one that was left behind. And so I guess it was basically her that was pushing my dad to gather up the nerve to move us all there. There was three of us, three siblings. I was the oldest of the three at that time. And so, I was 6 years old. And the whole thing, Bob, took about 3 years, that process. So I started hearing about the fact we were moving even 3 years before we actually moved. You know, vaguely I would catch what was going on, but my parents had to do a lot of paperwork kind of stuff to come over legally, and you had to have all these kind of documents signed, and my dad actually had to have, you know, some sort of employment that he was coming to, or people that could move him into a position somewhere. So it was a pretty rigorous process.
Is it right to say, was it primarily economic? Was that the motivation, or was it more to be near that family that had already gone over?
Well, I think if I had to say, you know, because I heard this kind of stuff from my parents later, there was two driving forces. One of them for sure was economic. Not that my family was necessarily impoverished, but, you know, they wanted more out of life than what they saw there in Monterey. And they always talked about how corrupt the government was. And so they wanted to kind of get away from that. And they all had the same vision that so many people have of the United States, that it was the land of freedom. And since my mother already had siblings, you know, my mother was the youngest of nine, and, you know, several of them were already here. And so that was another driving force, you know, to move to the United States so that she could, you know, reunite with her family.
Now, I've heard anecdotally from various people where, especially I knew some people that like came from Russia over, and when they would hear Americans complaining about their government, you know, the American government, they would just look at us like we were nuts. And they would be, you know, like, you don't understand. Like, yeah, the people shouldn't be doing these things. But were your parents like that? Because at first I was going to be real snarky when you were saying your parents like were upset at the corruption of the Mexican government. I was going to make a joke like, oh, so they came here where the politicians aren't corrupt. But I mean, I realize it's all graded on a curve and that some people might say, you know, you really don't understand how bad things can get. So do you have any sense of that?
Like, only from a child's perspective and the stories that I heard later about how the corruption was obviously pretty severe. And it was a situation where if you were connected to the government in some way, you know, you did well.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of money under the table if you wanted to get stuff done and a lot of that sort of stuff. So,
well, I guess what I'm asking, though, is do you ever, like, your mom or dad over the years in the U.S., did they ever make any offhand remark? Like, if someone was complaining about, you know, the government in the U.S., did they ever say anything like, oh, you have no idea? Or, you know what I mean?
Well, I think that they would in many ways, but what I think my parents found out once they moved here is that it was not a piece of cake to live in the United States. It was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that the whole move was a cultural shock because neither of them spoke the language. And so it was difficult.
Sure.
Much more difficult than they ever, you know, thought.
Okay.
So, in fact, as a child, I was the first one to actually learn how to speak English, and I basically became the interpreter, you know, to have to make, I was, of course, wasn't making the decisions, but when my parents had to, you know, arrange for insurance and, you know, buy this or buy that, I had to interpret for him. You know, I remember that very clearly. And it's kind of hard. You know, it's kind of hard on a child to have to do that kind of stuff. You sense the responsibility of it. But so we had to go through that learning experience. And I learned with him, you know.
So how does that work? You came over, you were 6 years old. So did you go into school right away?
I did. I was in school in Mexico, again, for a brief time because I was only six. But then when I came to the United States, yeah, I immediately went into school. And now this would have been in 1954, Bob, when that move took place. So the United States was a completely different place in 1954. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the schools, you know, were not segregated and all that. You know, it was just a whole different setup altogether. But I started going to school not knowing how to speak English, and that was rough on me for a while because, you know, it was like I couldn't understand what everybody was saying.
I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at is, like, you were just going to – your classes were all in English. Did they have, like, one class that was, like, ESL kind of stuff or
– No, it was just
– It was just sink or swim? They just threw you in the pool?
You just assimilated with what was going on. And, you know, it was, but, you know, it's amazing how children adapt very, very quickly. You make friends very, very quickly and – you're using sign language and whatnot just to be able to communicate, but, you know, kids are kids, and then you're picking up little bits and pieces, you know, at a time, and it comes fast for a child, much, much faster than it does for a grown-up.
Sure, yeah.
And even today, I don't know, you can speak to this yourself, but even today, people say to me, you know, you don't have an accent. You know, you don't speak with a Hispanic accent at all. They'll say that, man. Now, I don't know if that's really true. I just hear that a lot, and I don't know what you think about that. But all I can tell you is that I picked up the English language really, really fast. Mm-hmm. But it was not like it was taught to me necessarily. I just sort of picked it up as I went.
And did your parents and aunts and uncles or whoever the other people were, like, did they have a noticeable accent?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. In fact, I have two brothers that are younger and a sister, and they do have an accent. And I don't understand mm-hmm. that, but they do.
Yeah, that's on my family. I remember my dad's father, you know, they came from Ireland, and he got rid of his accent right away, whereas my dad's aunts kept their, you know, the brogue. And I remember that so my grandfather used to complain and say, come on, we're in a new country. Let's speak like them, you know, that kind of stuff. Real gruff guy.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit? I always found this fascinating is that, do I have the details right that your dad, pretty soon after you guys moved, instead of, you know, you might picture, oh, he goes to work in a factory or something. Didn't he like open up a general store or something pretty soon after the move?
He did. He absolutely did. And, he opened up the store within, I think it was 3 weeks of arriving. And how that happened was that before coming over, obviously my dad and my mother both were in communication with my mother's brother. And so they were providing letters so that wherever my dad had to present those in order to get his passport and everything and documented papers to come across the border and all that done, there was a person that my uncle introduced to my mom and dad when they arrived in the United States. And supposedly this person was wanting, because of her it was a lady, because of her relationship with my uncle, she was prepared to put up a little bit of seed money to put my dad into sort of like a retail operation. And so my dad came over knowing that this woman, again, strictly on the relationship my uncle had with this woman, that she was going to do that. And when, you know, when my dad arrived, met with the lady, of course, he doesn't speak any English. And so, but my uncle was the interpreter at that point. And, you know, it wasn't a lot of money. It was just this lady. It was just someone that, you know, obviously had an entrepreneurial mindset. And my uncle maybe gave this lady glowing reports about my dad. And so 3 weeks after we arrived, my dad, with the help of this woman, opened up this small, and gosh, Bob, you wouldn't even call it a retail operation. It's more like a, well, I have pictures of it, and it looks more like a little, looks like a little flea market shop, because we actually live behind the shop.
Right.
And so, and he sold, you know, knickknacks and stuff, socks and hosiery and shoes and, but not, there was no big, you know, depth of inventory in anything, like I said. So it was more or less just a little shop in a little sort of like a, sort of a strip center area in a neighborhood in Dallas, Texas. And so, yeah. So
well, I mean, I appreciate your humility and modesty here, but I mean, let's give the guy some credit. If I moved,
to
Mexico not knowing how to speak Spanish, 3 weeks in, if I had my electricity turned on and got my mail forwarded, I would think that was a moral victory. And he got his own store going. That's amazing.
Yeah, and he made it work. He made it work for around 4 or 5 years. So he provided a living, you know, for us all out of that operation. So yeah, I mean, he's got my respect for sure.
And I wonder, I don't know if you've ever thought of it like this, but I have this idea that, you know, you see patterns where, you know, Kirk Douglas is an actor and then his son Michael Douglas goes into it, or you see musicians where there's a famous rock star and then their kids are music. And clearly some of that is, you know, you could argue it's genetic or just, you know, they had connections and stuff because of their famous parents. But I think also, if your dad is a movie star, then it's not a big deal to you. You got movie stars over the house for parties and stuff, and so it's not that hard for you to get into it just because you think it's possible. You know it can be done. It's not intimidating. So I'm wondering, you're very entrepreneurial, and we'll obviously get into that perhaps later in this interview, but do you think just as a young kid, you've seen your dad just matter-of-factly, oh, yep, you moved to a new place and you go ahead and start a new business. That's what you do. Do you think that made you more entrepreneurial just because you grew up with that example?
I probably would say that had a lot to do with it because, you know, we, as children, you know, we learn by observing our parents, you know, we watch what they do and, you know, we think a great deal of our parents. I mean, they are our parents. And so I would say, yeah, I would probably say that a lot of that rubbed off on me.
Because the only reason I'm bringing that up is I remember I just thought there was a separate, and Tom talks about this a lot, Tom Woods on his shows, like when he was younger, and I get where he's coming from. Like you have this idea that, or I did at least, maybe you didn't because of your dad, and that's my point, is that, oh, there's these other people who are suited to start businesses, you know, and that, like as an economist reading Mises and stuff, I talk, you know, the entrepreneur, and I was in college and one of my roommates, he said, hey, let's start a t-shirt business. And I really just, because I like to really know how everything works. I like to know what I'm doing. I don't like feeling uncertain. And, you know, it was kind of a leap in the dark. We didn't know how to make shirts, but he says, oh, let's just order this thing. We'll figure it out. And so if it weren't for him pushing me through that, I wouldn't have done it. And then he did it. And I realized like, oh, wow, you can make a lot more per hour of your labor doing this way if it hits. Or, you know, you might waste all weekend making shirts and the ink washes off because you didn't figure out how the you know, drying process worked. So anyway, I'm just, you know, sort of going off on a tangent here, but saying like, I remember in my case, someone else kind of had to push me into it. And then I saw that, yeah, there's nothing really magical about being an entrepreneur. It's just being willing to start something new. Whereas a lot of people, I think, would rather work for somebody else. They would want somebody else to approach them and say, here's the job. I'll give you this money for your labor time. And I'm the one taking all the risk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. The lady that put up the little seed money in order to get it going, I mean, it really wasn't a whole lot of money. This lady was a nurse and she was single, you know, she was sort of like this nurse. So again, I'm trying to emphasize that there wasn't much stock to sell from, but I remember one particular time And it could only have happened because my dad was probably struggling to sell something in order to feed us. And apparently no business was coming in. But I remember very distinctly that he and my mother put like these little chocolate candy in these little bags and, you know, dressed them up with a bow and all this stuff. And he you know, they made, I don't know how many of those things. And they sent me around the neighborhood selling those little bags of candy. And so I was noticing, you know, that my mom and dad sort of put this together. Then I went door to door and sold this stuff to people, and they paid me money for it. And so I come back and I have money from, you mm-hmm. know, and all my little bags are gone. So I think that teaches you a lesson, you know. It teaches you, hey, you can do stuff here and earn money.
Right.
So, yeah, to answer your question, yeah, I think a lot of that stuff did rub off.
Huh. That, yeah, I'm not sure I had heard that particular one. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, but you said, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just adding to the fact that I'm sure it's because my dad was trying to stimulate some kind of income.
Right. Now, you mentioned a minute ago that where you guys landed, was it like, what, a suburb of Dallas?
Yes. Yeah. We came from Monterey to Dallas on a bus, and we traveled, I don't know how many hours on the bus, and I remember the border crossing, and I remember that we were on a Greyhound bus once we crossed the border. So I remember the Greyhound on the side of the bus. And I want to say it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was the only one on the bus that was awake. Everybody else was asleep. And I was up there trying to talk to the bus driver. And I remember to this day looking out into the horizon beyond the highway and seeing the skyline of Dallas. Mm-hmm. Now, this is 1954, so you go to Dallas now, I mean, those skyscrapers are huge, but the skyline—
And they look like they're 3 weeks old, too.
Yeah.
You know, they're sparkly.
But anyway, my point is that the skyline wasn't as big, but it was still a skyline, the skyline we didn't have where I came from. And one of the buildings in particular had the Texaco horse on it. That was the logo of the Texaco oil refinery. And it was very bright, and it was shining, it was blinking. And I looked out, and honestly, Bob, I'd never seen Disney World before, and I don't even think Disney World existed at that time, but it looked like a magical city from the bus. You know, I felt like I was coming into some sort of the land of the wizard or something. Mm-hmm. I remember that very, very distinctly. Yeah. And then, of course, when I arrived and it was day and the sun came out, I realized I was in a completely different place. Nothing at all like the country that I had left. And everything was new. Everything. Including something that I sat and stared at for I don't know how long, wondering what it was. And it was a TV set. And this is, you know, when those TV sets in the 1950s were just these boxes, you know. But I'd never seen one before, and I didn't know what it was.
So where were you? Was this in the bus station?
No. We arrived, and my uncle came and picked us up at the bus station and took us to his house.
Oh, okay. So at his house, you saw TV.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was still, you know, not quite daybreak, and everybody was still sleeping. Huh. I came in, and I think my parents just crawled back into bed, you know, because they were tired from the trip. And I saw that box in there, and it was turned off. But like I said, everything I looked at was new in the sense that I'd never seen stuff like this before. Mm-hmm. You know, everywhere I looked, there was a difference, a major difference. And so, but anyway, being in their house, that's where my eyes landed, was on that box, and wondered what it was. And eventually my aunt in the morning, she came in and flipped it on and I saw people in there and it was really something, you know, to see a TV set.
If you were interested in it before it was on, you must have been astonished when you flipped that thing in.
So anyway, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, that's great. Now, I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but it triggered my memory when you said you were in Dallas. You actually have some distant connection to the JFK assassination. Are you allowed to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Now, folks, the listeners probably their ears perked up and like, what? It's not going to be as exciting as I just made it sound. But go ahead. It's better than the average guy's story.
Well, this came about when I think I was about 16. And of course, those of us that remember that incident, I mean, it changed everybody's life forever. You know, it was just such a horrible thing. Now, the connection, Bob, was that I had a friend who lived two streets down from me, and we were in high school. He had a hot rod that he was working on. And I love that car. It was like a 1930-something Chevy. And he had some big, huge engine in it. I'd never heard the car crank up, but he was always working on it. And it was in his carport. And so on Sunday afternoons, I'd walk the two streets over and watch him tinker with that car. And we'd talk, and he would try to sell me on the idea he was going to crank that car up one day. And I was going to see just how fast this car really was, and I couldn't wait. But anyway, the houses were kind of close together, and there was a fence, and there was his neighbor, a relatively young girl. I was, like I said, I was 16 or so at the time. So she would have been somewhere around, I'm guessing, 20-something in that area, maybe a little older. And she would come out into the backyard. She would come over and kind of look over the fence where we were and start trying to talk to us. And the first thing I noticed about her was that she spoke very broken English. I mean, she was definitely a foreigner. I thought maybe she was Swedish. She had, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, very attractive. But she had this broken English. And I just got the feeling that she was very friendly because she was trying to practice her English. Mm-hmm. And so we talked to her, we'd say hello. And so.
And you guys had the cool car. I mean, let's not overlook that.
Well, the point is that every time I'd go over there, pretty soon she'd come out, you know, and. She, you know, got to know her name. She'd say hello and this, that, and the other. And then, of course, you know, one day I am in class and I hear that the president's been shot. And, of course, everybody just, you know, was in shock. You know, mm-hmm. Everybody was in shock. Not just my classroom and being that it was there in Dallas, but obviously the whole world was in shock. And so in following the news reports that were going on, because, you know, all of a sudden the police is running around and all this crazy stuff is going on and they're trying to chase down, you know, who did it and how it was done. They then start finally getting down to the fact that it was this guy named Harvey Oswald that had assassinated the president. He was the guy that they had in custody. And what later came out was that, you know, he had a wife, and his wife was Russian. And then they showed where he lived, and it was right there next door to my friend's house. So that young girl that was coming out was Harvey Oswald's wife. And at that point, you know, it's kind of like you came very, very close. About as close as you can get to the dark side of things, because the assassination of the president was definitely a dark, dark moment in the history of the United States. But it also changed my view of the world forever, because all of a sudden there were evil people out there that would do this kind of stuff. And I think it was that way for a lot of people during that. You know, it's kind of like our age of innocence was somehow shattered with that event.
So I have to, I mean, that's, you know, an amazing coincidence, I guess you say, but do you, like, was your friend questioned by the police? Do you know, like, just the fact that he lived next door to where, you know, the guy they thought did it? Let me ask you this. Did you ever, like, looking back, did you ever see Oswald? Did Oswald himself live in that house or not?
No, I never saw him. Okay. And then these little conversations were very brief. It was nothing extensive or anything like that. Oh, I'm sure his family was probably questioned, you know, because again, he was like a 16-year-old too.
Right. Sure. Know? Yeah. I suppose the other obvious question is, did you ever see Ted Cruz's father coming and going? Because it's a dumb joke. There was something during the campaign where the primaries where I forget even how it happened, but Donald Trump said something that it sounded like he was accusing Ted Cruz's father of helping Lee Harvey Oswald. So anyway, that's a joke. Some of the listeners might have chuckled at that. Let me now switch gears a little bit. Now that we've brought up the JFK assassination, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole right now, folks, but let me switch gears. There's, again, I'm trying to get some of these funny stories I've heard from you on the record. Can you tell us about, you were in the Marines and the story with the problem you had with your superiors and the dress code?
Okay. So one thing I should point out here is that when I came to the United States, you know, like I said, I just sort of assimilated into society, and so did my parents. You know, they just came in, they started working, you know, started paying taxes just like everybody else. Just, you know, just became part of the fabric of the United States. But we were living in the United States as residents. In other words, we weren't actual U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. And so I mentioned that to you in talking about the Marine Corps because, you know, when I turned 18, I had to, you know, register for the military because at that point, you just had to go into the service, you know, for 2 years. You were drafted, in other words.
Because this is the height of the Vietnam War. Is my timeline okay or not?
I'm sorry?
Or is it before? I'm trying to play. Is this right when the Vietnam War is really
hot? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. So it was during the Vietnam crisis, yes. And so I had a sort of a strange situation in that they had a lottery number system going, and it had to do with your birth date. They assigned everybody a number, and then they would make this general announcement that anybody that has this such and such numbers, you know, you had to go in. And so my lottery number was so low, Bob, that I was going to go in whether I wanted to or not. I mean, so that was my precarious situation during all of that. And as I was saying, I wasn't even a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. But I still, you know, had to go into the military. I still had to register. And again, we didn't have a volunteer armed forces at that time. So it was and there we were in the middle of a Vietnam crisis. And so they were calling up people right and left. And so the way I wound up into the Marine Corps, and I don't want to say anything derogatory about the Marine Corps, but, you know, of course, I didn't even want to go. I didn't want to go to war. I didn't believe in it. And there was a lot of riots and stuff going on the streets and people burning their draft cards and all this kind of stuff where, you know, the nation was really upset about this Vietnam conflict. Now, I wasn't doing all those things. I wasn't demonstrating or anything like that or burning my draft card, but I knew that I didn't want to go to war. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any sense in it. And by that time, when I was at that point, coming out of school, my wife of 47 years of marriage at that time was just graduating, you know, from school. And, you know, we were very serious about each other and she was worried. She wanted me to get into a reserve unit that, you know, through her connections and what people were telling her, she was saying, you know, if you can get in a reserve unit, you have a much greater chance of not going to war, to conflict, but instead you'll serve here in the United States. Now, you'll have to serve in the military for 6 years as a reservist, whereas if you go to war, you only go, I think it was 2 years, but your chances of getting killed were very high. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of situation. So my wife was pushing me really hard to get into a reserve unit because, you know, she did want to go ahead and get married, and I think I was ready to do that as well. The only problem was every reserve unit that was available was the National Guard, Army, you know, Air Force. They had, you know, the line was a mile long. You couldn't get in. And so the only one that had any opening in the reserve units was the Marine Corps. And of course, you know, the Marine Corps has this reputation of if you get into that particular unit, and if you go to war, you're going up on the front lines. You know, if you go in as an enlisted man, you know, so it was kind of like nobody wanted to go into the Marine Corps, but that was the only choice I had. And so I got into the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves and committed to be with them for 6 years and then 2 weeks every summer for 6 years. And so my first 6 months of that 6 years, I had to go through Marine Corps boot camp at Parris Island, just like so many other Marines that were going on to Vietnam. You had to go through the same stuff. But then after boot camp, I went to another base and spent the remainder of my 6 months there. And then from then on out, I just became a part-time military person on weekend meetings. You know, you had to go to the reserve unit every weekend and then 2 weeks in every summer. And so the incident you're trying to get me to talk about, Bob, is how I got crossways with the military, the Marine Corps, was that I was already out working. I was married and working. And it was during the era of, I guess, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, you know, and everybody was wearing long hair. Mm-hmm. But if you're in the Marine Corps, you couldn't do that. You had to wear what they refer to as white walls. You know, you just basically, the haircut is very similar to what you see today. You know, you're basically pretty well short. I mean, short. And so I always looked kind of like I was out of step with everybody because I was in the business world at that time. Everybody, you know, is sporting relatively long hair, and I look different because I'm in the military and I'm a part-time soldier. And so what happened is that somewhere along the way there, several of us decided because we looked over at the Army Reserve units and the National Guard Reserve units, and they had begun to wear short hair wigs. And so they would wear longer hair, you know, during the week when they were in their civilian life. And then when they had to report for duty on the weekends, and they would put on these short hair wigs.
Let me just stop you to make sure. So you're saying their actual real hair, they grew out. So, in the civilian world, they looked like they had normal hair. And then when they had to go report on the weekends to the reserve unit, they would push their hair up and put it under this wig that made it look like they still had the real short cut.
Exactly. Okay. So now these wigs were ridiculous. I mean, really, they were. But they were short, very short. And, you always wore a military cap, you know, when you were standing for inspection in front of a military officer, you know, when you would first show up at the military camp, you know, to do your weekend tour of duty. And so they would go down, you know, you're standing at attention in a file, and they're going in and they're inspecting you. You know, they're looking at every individual and see if they're dressed appropriately, their shoes are shiny, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think there was six of us in a company of, I don't know, 200, 300 people that were in that particular unit. And we were all wearing these short-haired wigs. And, you know, we got by with it for a long time. Now, again, I'm trying to tell you that the other reserve units, like the Army, the National Guard, the Air Force, they were all wearing short-haired wigs. They'd been using them for a long time, and that's where we got the idea. And so we, on one inspection, one of the six of us, the officer, the military officer, just looked a little too close and spotted some of that long hair coming out of the wig. And so we were, you know, he yanked that wig off of him, and it, all this long hair comes falling out. And so he started looking at everybody, made everybody take his hat off, their hats off, and that's when the rest of us were exposed. And so
now, at this point, I should say most people would have said, oh, we got caught. It was a good effort. And then you would have just followed the rules, but that's not what you guys did, right?
Right. Because, well, only because the U.S. Marine doesn't, they're a little bit different. They're pretty strict. And so what they were going to do was they started threatening us, sending us over, kind of like revoking our reserve status and shipping us over into combat. That's how angry they were over what we were doing. And so,
that's kind of where I'm coming from, that with that threat hanging over your head, like cut your hair or you're going to go over to Vietnam. Most people would have said, yes, sir, and they would have shaved their head.
Well, I think they didn't even give us that option. It was the fact that we had done that.
Right.
You know, if they'd have said, now, okay, we've caught you, you go shave your head, you know, I would have done that without a problem. But no, they were going to do what they were going to do. Now, it could have been at the time they did that, Bob, that they were just trying to really scare us, you know.
Right.
It could be. But they kept it up. You know, they drug us in for several meetings. And so we were pretty upset. And I remember I was at home one day with some friends. We were just, you know, out having dinner and everything. One of my friends was a young attorney. He was just getting started. And I was talking about my situation. And he just looked at me and he said, oh, well, why don't you sue him? I mean, he said it so casually, like, and I took him seriously because he was a reservist in the Army and he wore a short-haired wig, mm-hmm. You see, and he just kind of thought like he had a case because the Army was doing it. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And he just so nonchalant said, just sue him. And once he threw that out there, you know, I did take him up on it, and that's what we did. And just to finish this little tale for you, on the day of appearing before the judge, you know, we're there, and there's my young attorney friend who's going to represent the six of us there. And over on the other side is, you know, all these military officers, and they were all dressed in their military uniforms with all their medals and stuff. You know, so it looked like a real powerful front there. And the judge is, is talking to the attorney. What's going on? What's the case? And you know, trying to get an understanding of it. And so they give him the situation. And the judge says, let me see one of those wigs. And so at that point, you know, my attorney takes the wig up to the bench, gives it to the judge, and he calls a recess. And he goes in back into his chambers, and we're all sitting out there. And you hear this guy, you hear his laughter in his office back in the back. He's laughing. And what I later found out is that he was bald. Uh-huh. and so he was trying the wig on and looking in the mirror and started cracking up. And so anyway, when he came back out, he dismissed the case. And so in a sense, it was a victory for us. Now, we didn't actually push that envelope. In other words, we didn't show up the next week with these wigs on. You know, we we did cut our hair and, you know, try to fall back in place. But it was a victory for us because we were very afraid that they were going to do something serious to us.
Yeah. Well, that's anyway, I said that was funny about most people. It would never have occurred to me to sue the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, but that's what you did. And
well, I've never heard anybody else doing it before.
Yeah. Why don't I pause here, Carlos, in order to tell the folks about an opportunity to come see you and me talking about Austrian economics and IBC. That's right, folks. Carlos and I, along with David Stearns, are putting on a seminar for the general public on IBC, the infinite banking concept. It's going to be Saturday, October 13th, 2018, in the Fort Worth area. We give a crash course in Austrian economics, particularly talking about the business cycle and tying it to the current state of the economy. And then most of the seminar is on IBC. How does it work? The mechanics. How do you tailor one of these policies to your own circumstances? And then we stick around, of course, and field questions you may have. For more details, go to ibcseminar.com. Why don't we fast forward here, Carlos? You became a workout specialist. Is that the right way to describe what it was that you were doing?
Yes, very, very early on. And it was actually consulting was a new field when I got into it. And how I got, you know, how I eventually got into it was just helping business owners that were in the footwear and apparel industry control their inventories. Now, this would have been at a time, Bob, when we didn't have computers. And so every inventory controls was more or less a manual process and, you know, very antiquated to the way it is today. But it was we had a situation within the retail and manufacturing environment where there was an over concentration of retail establishments in downtown cities, because we didn't have shopping malls during that period of time. The shopping mall was more or less a new innovation. And so most retail was in downtown cities across the country. And so when the idea of the mall concept came out, obviously mall developers began selling these merchants that were located in cities on the idea that if they would move to the suburbs with another retail operation, that it would double their revenue. And so they sold them on that idea, you know, just open up another store and you'll have twice the revenue. Never mind, you're going to have twice the expenses, but it was sold on an expansionary kind of a idea and concept, because they sold them on the idea that this is where things were heading toward the suburbs, away from the cities. And so you saw that kind of thing happening across the nation with more and more retail operations opening multiple stores out in the shopping malls as the shopping malls began to spread all over the place. Well, that presented a nightmare for manufacturing concerns, because they were actually bankrolling all these additional inventories for these merchants who were very good at managing one store location. But when it came to managing 10 store locations or, you know, that kind of thing, they were losing control of their inventory. And since manufacturers were, in essence, bankrolling that expansion of inventories, we started to see an enormous amount of problems develop within that sector. The footwear and apparel industry developed enormous amount of problems. And so
just to let the listener, so is this like what, in the 70s we're talking?
Yes. Okay. That's exactly when it was, the early 70s. And so it started out, first of all, in, again, trying to control inventories. And but some of these things, some of these operations were getting into a lot of much deeper, serious financial problems. And so a lot of them were filing for bankruptcy as the only alternative when things just got to a point where they couldn't be salvaged anymore. I think the legal side of things would advise these merchants that the way out was to just file for what is known as a Chapter 11. And there, in bankruptcy, they had a much better chance of reorganizing their company, which is not true, especially if you're a small business. That what you learn is that in these, once you go into bankruptcy, it really becomes a situation where they're going to wind up liquidating the assets of the business, and basically that's going to be the end of your company. So the kind of work that I got involved in was a workout arrangement outside of bankruptcy. And so in my relationship with a lot of these manufacturing concerns that had all these clients, these retailers, and they wanted to help save them rather than see them go into bankruptcy, I started getting called on to do these informal reorganizations outside of bankruptcy. And so that's how we refer to them as workouts, you know, workouts outside of bankruptcy. And the goal is to reduce the business down to a profitable level. And you may have to liquidate some concerns, some outlets, cut expenses, you know, do that kind of thing. But the idea is to pay off the debt and save the business for the long haul.
And it was in doing this, I mean, so this is where you really had your finger on the pulse of business, and, you know, you were familiar with seasonality and you really understood how business owners would think. And then, you know, you were quite successful in doing this, and then you just got completely blindsided by what happened in the late 70s, early 80s with the interest rate spikes. And then I know also the 86, 87 fiasco. So can you maybe just briefly explain what happened there and then how that led you to the Austrian school? Because I'm sure my listeners would like to hear, you know, that's an unusual story. Most people get into it, you know, for ideological reasons, or they're young kids who are just reading something and they stumble upon Rothbard or something. But you actually were a man on a mission to figure out what the heck just happened.
Well, sure. I was very successful in that business. So my primary work, of course, was, you know, helping these businesses survive. And I couldn't handle a lot of cases at once because they really pulled you in. It took a while to solve a case, sometimes as long as 18 months to be able to prop it back up to where it was operating again. And so you really couldn't take on a lot of different situations. So I wound up handling some pretty big cases, and I obviously did well with it. What I didn't know, Bob, is that, I didn't know it well enough because, again, I was still young. But, you know, change is inevitable. You know, nothing stands still. So the whole structure of the, you know, just things going on in the country were changing dramatically. And if I could describe what was going on, there was a contraction that was occurring almost in every sector of the economy. You know, things were consolidating and contracting, whether it was people merging, people, you know, things were just in a state of change. And when you're a business owner, obviously you need to be aware of these changes and need to understand that, you know, you also have to be, you know, managing risk and seeing where all these changes are going to take you. But there was one area that I really didn't understand very well, and that was, first of all, I would say the inner workings of banking I didn't understand, even though, you know, I was in business and used banks and actually had to negotiate with banks in order to solve a problem. But banking, you know, the intricacies of it itself, I wish I'd have known more about it at the time I was doing it. And the reason I say that is because with this change came me having to expose myself more in order to make some of these workouts actually work out. And so what I started doing is having to take on some additional financing for myself, as most business owners would do, using commercial banks and lines of credit. Now, I didn't...
Let me just stop you for a second. So you're saying you would come into like the suppliers, the people who are sending, you know, retail clothing to some particular outlet. They knew that the person was behind, you know, they owed him money. And so they're thinking, gee, what do we do here? And they were in a dilemma because they knew if they just cut the person off, the business was going to tank and then they were only going to get pennies on the dollar. But on the other hand, they didn't want to just keep sending them inventory saying, oh, pay us back when you can, because it's like a black hole. It's just getting worse and worse. So they would call you in, the suppliers would, and you'd go in and you'd assess the business and see, hey, is this thing salvageable if they just had better management? And in order for you to, in some of these cases, for you to get the bank to kind of back off and to get some of these suppliers to continue to ship product so that the business wouldn't, the retail outlet wouldn't have to shut down. In some of these cases, you had to put your own money on the line in order to make the thing work, to give them some breathing room to the outlet. Am I correctly summarizing what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was part of what I meant, that things were changing. There was contraction going on. When I first got into the business, there was a feeling on the part of creditors, whether it's either the bank and or suppliers shipping one of these companies, that there was still value in saving the business. In other words, they felt that there was a reason for the business to go forward. And so these creditors were willing to extend themselves, you know, actually put more money into it in a sense, to give me time to work the situation out where then they can recoup their money. All right. That's how it started initially. But as things started contracting in the economy, there was a change in how these creditors and banks started feeling about some of these retail outlets that I was working on, some of these retail operations that I was working on, and that they started thinking that, no, I don't think they deserve to be kept alive, and I'd rather not throw good money after bad. So you had more and more of that spirit, you know, coming into it. And that's what was causing me. There was this idea that everybody had to have skin in the game before anybody. Nobody wanted to risk on their own unilaterally. Everybody needs to have some skin in the game if they're going to do something. So you had more of that attitude going on. And so I understood that because of the change in environment. And so sometimes I would need to actually partially finance some of these things myself, in addition with the help of some of the major creditors involved. But not all creditors felt like they needed to support a business that was in trouble. So it was under those particular circumstances that I began to kind of, leverage myself by utilizing bank letters of credit in order to, you know, finance inventories partially on some of these workouts. So what happened, and this came really unexpectedly, is that at one point, you know, during that period of time, the interest rate was pretty high and it was escalating higher. And it shot up to like over 21% interest. And I was exposed, you know, to quite a bit of bank debt at that point. And it created a real scare for me. And as it did for so many people throughout a lot of people failed during that period of time. A lot of businesses failed. The interest rate just shot out of nowhere to those levels. So
just to understand the situation. So at this point, like we're talking what, the late 70s here?
Yes.
And you were doing very well, like, you know, making nice net income. But at any given time, you're seeing the way the business changed and the credit contraction and whatnot. You ended up having to, you were personally on the hook and you were like rolling over these bank letters of credit. And so as long as interest rates were reasonable, you were fine. But then when they shot up, you were all of a sudden in a situation where you at that moment had a lot of outstanding debt that you owed. And now is rolling over at 21%, you're getting killed. Is that the situation?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so when interest rates get that high, not only are you going to have trouble working out the problems for your clients, but it's going to affect you too. And so these interest rates and how they shot up the way, you know, these are pieces that I was growing to understand, but I didn't quite understand, you know that clearly. It really created it was a tremendously big wake-up call. And of course, once that started to happen, it seems like changes started happening even more faster, you know, than even I recall from previous times. And so it was during that period of time that I realized that I began to realize that you could be a business, someone in business doing well and doing all this kind of stuff. But then all of a sudden there was these forces that you really couldn't control that would occur that could completely derail you, you know, and bankrupt you. And so, you know, once I saw some of the experience that occurred then later in the 80s, after we had the 1986 Tax Reform Act and saw the collapse of the real estate market to the levels that it did, really worse since the Depression. And then we had, of course, following right after that, Black Monday in 1987, you know, where the stock market, you know, really took this tremendous nosedive. You know, that I think that was about the time that because I myself was scrambling to keep my own company afloat, you know, because things were happening so rapidly. And thank goodness that I never had to file for bankruptcy or anything like that. But I tell you what, it set me back quite a bit. And I lost quite a bit of money throughout that whole process. And you don't recoup losses like that overnight. I mean, it was a true hardship that came on not only on me but my entire family, simply because it really just, you know, it's like having the rug pulled out from under you. And so that's when I started to realize that I needed to find out more about what made this sort of things happen. Because I was thinking, you know, it's kind of like you're not really doing anything wrong. You know, you're just doing your work and doing good work, but things can happen that could completely derail you. And so I guess that's when I began my quest to find the answer to that. And so that was a process of trying to, you know, start opening books again and start studying and start trying to, you know, things that would explain better to me what, you know, how is it that all this comes together? How does that really work? And I guess it was when I finally hit on the Austrian school that it all, you know, started to make sense. I mean, literally, it was like scales falling off my eyes. Okay, then now I understand what's going on.
Now, do you remember any of the specifics? Like, how did you, like, you remember, oh, I read this and then I read, you know, because I can remember what my progression was, that my dad used to listen to Rush Limbaugh and I loved that. And I was like, I had never heard. I remember the issue was, believe it or not, it was whether public schools should hand out condoms as a way to reduce HIV. Like that was the big deal when I was like in junior high. And Rush, and I just, matter of fact, oh, why wouldn't they? And then Rush Limbaugh's, you know, going off about, no, this is going to tell kids that it's okay to have premarital sex and you're going to have more pregnancies and da, da, da. And regardless of the specifics of that case, that was the first time. I think I was in seventh grade. Am I getting mixed up with the time? I can't remember. I was either in seventh or eighth grade or maybe, no, actually, maybe it was a freshman in high school. But it was right around then when that was the first time I'd ever heard the theory. Actually, it must have been in high school. Yeah. It was the first time I had heard the theory that just because the government announces some program with a policy that, you know, with an aim, at least from the public's point of view, it might not achieve that goal. Like, I had never heard that before. And then my dad, he had this thing called the Conservative Chronicle, and I got that. And that was like a collection of all the op-eds, the conservative writers like Mona Charon and Cal Thomas and people like that. And then it was within there, I noticed that it was The Economist that they would occasionally run. It was Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams in particular. And I said, oh, this is it. And I realized it's not so much that I cared about conservative politics and, you know, commentary on that. It was more like free market economics. And then I got National Review, the magazine, and there was an article where there was a disaster and people were doing the Keynesian explanation of, oh, this is how this will be good for the economy. You know, there's an earthquake and at least that'll stimulate spending. And the guy said, oh, Henry Hazlitt must be rolling over in his grave. And I was like, who's Henry Hazlitt? And then, you know, the person explained economics in one lesson. I got that. And then that was really, and at some point I got, you know, Mises Human Action. And then I got the Liberty, or was it Liberty Fund? Yeah, it was a Liberty Fund catalog. And then every Christmas I'd be getting big Fed economics books. And I remember I had to hunt down Human Action. I had to call, because it certainly wasn't in my bookstore. And this was before, you know, you can just go onto Amazon or something. And I shopped around and I had to call the bookstore at Hillsdale College because they had some copies of Human and they mailed it. And I got that as a senior in high school. So I remember distinctly my particular path. And I'm wondering, do you remember like what you started reading that led you to this and led you to that? And then finally you read what we now know as the Austrian theory of the business cycle.
Well, I didn't know any of the names of that are associated with the Austrian school. I mean, I had no idea of any of that. At the time that I was grappling with, you know, with some of the issues that I was going through with, you know, and trying to deal with my own business. And you have to keep in mind, Bob, that these events, they really took a toll, you know, financially. I mean, they really hit me hard. And I myself was trying to liquidate assets, pay off debt, you know, trying to do all kinds of things because I had done the typical thing that most people do even today. I mean, during the periods that I was doing real well, you know, I was moving ahead and I was getting into, you know, all kinds of things. And of course, one of the things I got into was real estate. And I got into real estate because there were some advantages to getting into real estate, you know, for tax purposes. And everybody in the nation was using them. And so I was very much involved in real estate and trying to, you know, like everybody else, trying to figure out a way how to cut my taxes and do those kinds of things that we see people doing even today. And of course, when the tax law changed, you know, they changed those particular advantages that you got with real estate. And of course, that's what brought the real estate market down. And so I was having to deal with the ramifications of that. You know, there was phantom income to deal with. There was money that was owed to the IRS that I had to come up with. So, I mean, it just compounded one problem after another. So I was like inundated with all kinds of problems. But I was not trying to find out necessarily, you know, the answers there. I just knew that I was going to start on my quest because this, I just couldn't believe this was all happening to me. But I didn't listen to guys like you said, Rush Limbaugh, or people like that. The guy that I listened to a lot and read a lot of his stuff. Do you ever hear a guy named Peter Drucker?
I know the name. I didn't follow him.
Yeah, yeah. So I, you know, for some reason he was more the guy that I read and listened to and talked about And to me, he represented, you know, how things ought to be done in the economy. And like I said, I was aware of Friedman. He was probably the most popular economist for me at the time, and I read several of his books. And so but I didn't get anything out of them necessarily. I mean, they didn't really sink in very well. So no, I didn't have now, but it was through drugs.
Oh, see, can I just stop you? I didn't know that. So you like, do you remember, was it like Free to Choose?
Yeah, those kind of books, yeah. But again, you know, it wasn't the same kind, I wasn't getting the same kind of information that I get from the Austrian school and the Austrian writers, you know. It wasn't the same thing. Now, I believe, and I don't know if it was Drucker and or Friedman where I first heard Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson. So that really was my first book that introduced more or less the whole Austrian way of looking at things. You know, the broken window thing was very enlightening, all that kind of stuff. And so from there was my path into learning more about it. But I didn't have any contact with anyone that was in it. You know, it was kind of like a lonely walk for a long time.
And then just for our listeners, some of you may know this, but the way Carlos and I actually met was that, you know, I was living in Nashville at the time, and that's where you still are. And then I get an email. I don't remember if it was from you or from Paige on your behalf, the assistant, someone that was working with Carlos at that time, saying you were going through my study guide to, was it Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State? Is that what you were using?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And then it said on the back of it, you know, you had the physical printed version, I guess. And on the back, it mentioned that, you know, Robert Murphy is an economist living in Nashville. And so, oh, what? And so that's how, you know, you communicated to me and we ended up having our meeting and the rest is history. But I thought that was interesting because what you were doing is you were working on a PowerPoint presentation that you were going and giving to bankers, explaining to them the fractional reserve banking system. And you just wanted to bone up on that and make sure you really understood exactly, like, you know, the balance sheets and how does fractional reserve banking work. So you were relying on Rothbard and my study guide to make sure you had all your T's crossed and I's dotted. And am I getting that right? Is that what you were doing at that point?
That's more or less how it happened. Now, I had met Nelson, and this is going back 15, 16 years ago.
But by the way, just for our listeners, so he's talking about Nelson Nash, the author of Becoming Your Own Banker and the founder of IBC, the Infinite Banking Concept.
Yeah, how I met him was I saw a copy of his book on somebody's desk, and I read the book, and the book intrigued me. And intrigued me so much that, you know, I made a trip out to Birmingham. I called him up and I made a trip out to visit with him to try to understand what it is that he's talking about in that book of his. And I actually had two meetings with him about that, kind of back to back within a few months. But in one of those meetings, one of those early meetings with him, I saw a copy of a book in his briefcase. And it was a book that was written by Professor Paul Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And it was a textbook that he had written on the spread of Western civilization. And I can't remember the title of it exactly, Bob, but it had something to do with, he was trying to make the case that it was actually the spread of Christianity that had set up Western civilization. And I saw the book and
Was it Unmasking the Sacred Lies?
No, it was before that one. Understanding the Cultural Wars was part of the title in it, but I can't remember the full title at the moment. But I saw the book and I asked.
Yeah, I think just to start. Yeah, it's Understanding the Modern Culture Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I asked Nelson about the book and wonder where I get a copy. I said, "Joey, you can have it." He said, "That's one of my heroes," he said. And so I read that book and really enjoyed reading the book. And so on one of those early visits to Birmingham to visit with Nelson, he brought Paul in at one time. We had lunch and got to meet him and we talked. And it was at that point that Paul, who is from the Austrian view of things, the Austrian school, began to talk along those same lines. And you know, I connected with that. And I started talking to him on the phone some about the Austrian school and asking for a little bit of direction as to where I should go to learn more about it. And I remember he suggested that I read all of Bastiat's stuff, you know, information and books that he had put out, like The Law and others. And so little by little, I was gaining more and more of the authors. And somewhere along the line there is when I grabbed hold of Murray Rothbard's books, read all of them. And now at this point, I'm really absorbing this information because I'm relating to it, to what had happened to me. Mm-hmm. And at the focal point on it all was the commercial banking system and the Federal Reserve at the center of all of this, along with what the kinds of things that government does. And so, I mean, my education just, you know, really took off at that point, and I couldn't stop reading. I couldn't quite tackle human action once I learned human action. But I did realize that there was another one like it, which was Man, Economy, and State. And I knew Murray Rothbard at that time, but his book was certainly easier to try to tackle than Human Action. But it, you know, it's still a pretty heavy duty book. And then I realized that you had written a study guide on it, and so I got a hold of that in order to help me along with it. And then I, of course, I made contact with you. Now, before I made contact with you, though, I had enough ammunition just from Rothbard alone to create the PowerPoint presentations that I started taking to commercial banks. This would have been somewhere around the 2007 time period, and I was very surprised that they didn't throw me out of the room. In fact, they actually more or less put me on a speaking circuit. It's almost like they didn't even know they did what they did.
And yeah, and I thought that was fascinating too. So again, just to make sure the listeners get what we're saying here, you were going up and going through, what was it, like 45 minutes, an hour, something like that?
Yeah.
A presentation. And it was, by the way, folks, this was, I told Carlos this, you know, when we first started getting to know each other. I when I saw him give this thing the first time, I went up to him after and I was like, this is, you know, if somebody wanted their mother-in-law to see a presentation on how fractional reserve banking work, I would have you do it, because if I tried to do it, I would end up using jargon, you know, that would be too economistic-y, or somebody else who was real glib might not get the details right. And yet this thing was perfect, that it was just the bright blend of, you were talking about like Caesar debasing the currency just to get their minds working and how, you know, and I just thought it was great. But the, you know, all your details were perfectly solid in terms of the accounting of it and everything. So that was amazing. And so you're doing this, you're giving it to commercial bankers. So remember, folks, this was, at this point, was right before the financial crisis when he started this stuff. So, and yeah, they not only did they not get mad at you, but they put you on a speaking circuit and you were telling me how you're going to go give the press. And I thought you were crazy at first. Like, are you kidding me? So, I mean, because it was, just for people to understand, you would sort of give a disclaimer in the beginning saying something like, look, at what I'm going to say here is very critical of this practice, and I'm going to show you the harm that it does to the economy. But I want you to understand, we're all born into this system, and it's not that I have any animosity or criticism for any particular person who might work for a bank, and I just want you us all to realize what's going on here. So you kind of diffused it that way. But as you're saying, like, a lot of these people, they might have worked at a bank for 15 years and not really understood, like, oh my gosh, we actually expand the money supply. I had no idea.
And that, you know, and when I think back on it, Bob, is that I definitely had a lot of built-in passion for what I was saying, almost as though I was trying to expose a truth that most people did not know. And it's because I had suffered, you know, I had actually suffered by what they do, that I had this sort of built-in passion to make it known. And I don't know whether that made the presentation, you know, that much more entertaining for them to see. It was a PowerPoint, so, you know, I was able to explain through that. And you're right, I would start with what Caesar did way back then, and it sort of brought the presentation together.
I should say something, though. When people hear PowerPoint, they might think that we mean you had, you know, something up there in 18-point font, and then you had a bunch of bullet points that would zoom in when you kept pressing the clicker. And no, when Carlos does a PowerPoint, it is a work of art, and I'm almost not even saying that tongue-in-cheek. Like, it really... It you'd have to see it. I guess they could get a taste of it, because if you get our book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, the diagrams in some of the chapters there were adapted from Carlos's PowerPoint that we're talking about here. So you can get a sense of it, but to really see it in its full glory, like, he was doing stuff with PowerPoints I didn't know you could do. I guess the only other example I've seen is if people have seen Roger Garrison's PowerPoints, you know, showing the boom bust cycle, but, you know, doing things that, geez, that, so... It was a lot more than just words flying in from the right hand of the screen or something every time you click the thing. This was a very visually appealing presentation that, when all was said and done, you really went from knowing nothing to understanding how fractional reserve banking worked. It was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and so I was doing that, and of course, at the same time, I was trying to learn more. And then again, I'd learned that you had written that study guide for Manicon and State, and that you were living in Nashville on top of that. So I immediately got in touch with you, and that's how we came together.
Yeah, and as we say, the rest is history. Now, just as a note for our listeners, at this point, it would perfectly make sense if we went off onto another hour-long discussion about how you introduced me to the infinite banking concept and, you know, my trouble and then eventual triumph in conquering that in terms of making my seeing it, whether I believed it or not. But we've covered all that territory on our own podcast named The Laura Murphy Show. So I don't want to retread that familiar ground here because we've carefully documented that in the early episodes over there. So maybe it's a good story. I mean, hey, we're interesting guys, but I'm going to purposely skip over that stuff because that's probably the people listening to this who know who you are anyway. That's how they know you, is our collaboration on IBC matters that we've covered so much over at the Laura Murphy Show. So what I want to maybe now transition to here is you wrote a series of articles for the Laura Murphy Report, the LMR, which I'll be honest with you. When you started doing the research and told me what you were doing, I was a little bit nervous. Because I didn't know how crazy you were coming. And just as background for folks, when Carlos gets an idea in his head, and he just goes into it. So for example, he decided to read the Dodd-Frank Act. I mean, he really got into the thing and just started going through it and reading it and taking notes, and then came back to me and said, "You know what this is? This is going to be bail-ins. This is bankruptcy law. This is it." And Carlos was using this term bail-in and telling me what that meant. I'm not kidding, folks. It was well before I saw like Zero Hedge talking about it. So at this point, you know, that's all the cool kids know about that. But for real, we really were breaking stories in the Laura Murphy Report because of Carlos's research on that. And so that's what I'm saying. He would just get something, or he would go another one. He read The City of God. He did a bunch of, you know, articles on that. He gets a hold of something and digs into it. And so in this one, the title of the series was it Who Runs the World? Is that what it was?
Right.
Yeah, and so, again, you know, it was a little bit like, where are you going to go with this, Carlos? Again, we're here, we are a nice, not conservative politically, but, you know, in terms of culturally, financial publication, where we're talking about Austrian economics and the infinite bank concept, and then you're doing articles on who really runs the world. So the way it came out, I like it was that it was very provocative claims you were making and, you know, talking about the research you had uncovered. But I think, you know, it was very sober, and your sources, you weren't saying, yeah, I saw some guy that was on InfoWars. I mean, you were giving very valid backup, and it really did make sense of things. So why don't I'll stop with the preamble here and just let you maybe talk a little bit about how did you pick that topic and what were some of the takeaways for people who are curious, like, oh, yeah, now that you bring it up, who does run the world?
And I guess probably, Bob, that was the reason that I started down that track, because everybody still wonders that even today. Even you and I, you know, are constantly, you know, going back and forth trying to figure out who's pulling the strings here, you know. So everybody has some notion of that there's all kinds of dark things going on in the world, and who's really doing this? Who's behind all this, you know? And we can try to get at some answers, and we do, but it's always a nagging question. And so that's how I started, you know, with that series. And it turned into three separate articles. I'm not sure I had that in mind when I first started down that track, but I remember that the very first article I wrote had to do, started out me talking about the first time I came into the dark side of things, and we've already covered that with the assassination of President Kennedy. And, you know, I don't know, I can't remember how long ago that happened, but even still today, you know, nobody knows for sure who killed him or why. And everybody's got some theory, you know, and it's been years. And so all we know is that somebody did away with him. But we have this nagging feeling inside that something sinister is going on here, because I think the statistics show that well over 75% of the people don't believe the Warren Report. And so there's always this nagging thing, you know, who's pulling the strings in all of this? And so that's how that started. And I somehow, and quite honestly, I don't even know how I came on this, Bob, but I came across a book that was written by this Professor Quigley, who I think he passed away in the, I believe it was the early 70s. But anyway, he was a Harvard historian and then eventually taught a school, taught at another school after that. And one of his students was Bill Clinton. And what I heard about it, that no one got very good grades in his class. And Bill Clinton, who we were supposed to think that he's a pretty bright guy, and I think he is, he made B's in there. Everybody else was making D's. But anyway, Quigley writes this book that gets to the bottom as to who runs the world. Now, it's a big book. It's like a 1,000 pages long, Bob. And I remember asking you if you ever heard of this guy before, and you hadn't. And, you know, I remember telling you that I was going to read it, and then I was going to try to write some articles on it because the book, it was pretty fascinating. And Quigley, by his own admission, was saying that it was 20 years in the making. So, no, it took him 20 years to write this book. Well, in the book, he basically says that he was actually allowed to study some very confidential papers of a group of men that way back before World War I had sort of made a vow to change the world for the better. And the thing you learn is that one of the key guys was this guy named Cecil Rhodes, and another guy was his name was Milner, and another party was one of the Rothschilds. And so their whole idea was that they the English, because of the aristocracy that these individuals came from, you know, were a privileged class and that had access to, you know, education that average people and people of other nations didn't have. And so they had this idea that they had a responsibility to educate the masses and provide help for the masses and somehow figure out a way to cure diseases around the world, to even to stop wars. And so the plan was, in a sense, to establish the kingdom of God on earth. So that was the elaborate plan that these guys conceived. However, they said that they wanted to do this on a very secretive basis. In other words, they didn't want it known that they were doing this. But obviously, they had an enormous amount of money behind the project because Cecil Rhodes was a very wealthy man, and he owned all of the diamond mines in South Africa. He had ownership to all of that, and of course, he had Rothschild money, and so he had quite a bit of wealth, and he established these wills and these trusts to make sure that his plan, you know, would have staying power even after his death. And so he would select key people with what he called the round tables. So these key individuals in society, and he would handpick these people if they became, he would offer scholarships to Oxford, referring to them as Rhodes Scholars. And he would offer scholarships to these very bright students from all over the world to come to Oxford. And then if they had the right personality and the right talent, he would select those people to be in his secretive group of roundtables. And I brought up Bill Clinton because, as you know, he was a Rhodes Scholar. And Clinton, by his own admission, when he was inaugurated as president somewhere along the line after that, he stated very clearly that it was Quigley, having him as a professor and the things that Quigley wrote about in this book that really, really was the really showed him how the world really works. And if you're...
Yeah, let me just jump in for a second here. So again, for those of you who are new to this stuff, so this book, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page here to make sure I get my details down. So it looks like it was in 1966 that Quigley first published what was a one-volume history of the 20th century titled Tragedy and Hope. So let me, so people understand just how explosive some of this. So again, this guy, he's got his PhD from Harvard. He taught at Princeton and Harvard, then I think at Georgetown is where he was for a while. And so this passage is the sort of the money quotes that if somebody wants to grab your attention, they read, you'll hear anytime someone brings up this stuff. So this is from that book. Again, from this PhD guy, you know, Ivy League education and professor. And he says, "This radical right fairy tale, which is now an accepted folk myth in many groups in America, pictured the recent history of the United States in regard to domestic reform and in foreign affairs is a well-organized plot by extreme left-wing elements." And then dot, 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 so we're skipping ahead. "This myth, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth. There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates, to some extent, in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Roundtable Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other group and frequently does so. I know of the operation of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims and have, for much of my life, been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected, both in the past and recently, to a few of its policies, and dot, 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 but in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known." Okay, so his deal is he's telling the world there really are these secretive groups. It's not what like the John Birch Society would have you believe, but there really are these groups, and it's basically they're very much pro-UK. Like they believe in the old British Empire and think that was the pinnacle of civilization. And now they're working behind the scenes, these very rich and connected individuals, to achieve their ends. And they have various mechanisms in place to do it. And Quigley thinks that's great. He agrees with them. He thinks, yeah, I want them to achieve their ends, you know, more or less. His big thing is just they're keeping it real secret. And I think everyone should know what they're doing. Let's just put it out in the open. So I'll also mention, just so our listeners don't get the wrong impression, plenty of what we would be dismissed as, quote, conspiracy theorists, you know, like G. Edward Griffin, people like that, they would write their own works and then rely heavily and say, oh, we're getting a lot of this from Quigley. And Quigley kind of denounced, might not be the right word, but kept them at arm's length and said, yeah, these guys, they're saying that they're getting it from me, but, you know, they're going off and they're seeing connections that I'm not drawing. So the point being that, and that's what you did, Carlos, in your articles that I liked, is you were very careful to say, look, if you go down in this genre, you're going to end up seeing, you know, people are going to talk about there's shape-shifting lizards from other dimensions coming and they run the world. So you were not going that far in your thing. You were just saying, though, that on the other hand, this is not completely made up out of whole cloth. There really are these, you know, organizations of international bankers and such, and it's very naive to just look at the way CNN reports things in the New York Times and think, oh, well, there's an election every 4 years and America picks who the president is and we're in charge of our own destiny and just wars just happen out of nowhere.
Well, that's right. And Quigley was very upset with a lot of the versions that came out. I mean, he himself had trouble publishing that book. He was able to publish 8,000 copies. And when he went back to the publisher wouldn't publish anymore. And Quigley was saying that somebody's trying to stop me from publishing this. But there was 8,000 copies already out there, and they did fall into hands of a lot of different folks that were just, you know, shocked at what he had found. And he, like you said, Bud, they wrote their own takes on it. A lot of religious people got a hold of it too and created their own version of it all. And while Quigley only sold 8,000 copies, some of these people that have taken off with some of his stuff have sold millions of books, you know, with all kinds of stuff. And Quigley was very upset about all that because they were, he kept saying that they were misrepresenting, you know, what he had written about. So anyway, it's enough for me to say that in my path to learn about Austrian economics and how it so centers a lot on what happens in banking and with the workings of the central bank and all of that, you know, Quigley had much the same thing to say. And Quigley himself basically alludes to the fact that the reason we wound up with a central bank in the United States is because this outfit wanted a central bank in the United States in order to help finance World War I. In other words, they ultimately wanted to cure all wars, but they weren't afraid to have wars along the way in order to to get it all straight. And so Quigley points out that in the process of all this, they gained control of all the news media, both in England and also in the United States. They had, you know, powerful connections. Rockefeller eventually became, you know, part of that group. And so there's a lot of money behind it all, a lot of power. And so this whole business of the one world order that you hear a lot about, you know, Quigley, in a sense, you know, uses that term long before you started hearing it from Bush and whatnot. So it's a great book to get at the source of, you know, the answer to that question, you know, who really does run the world? And most of it centers on today, when you think about it, and Quigley was, you know, kind of ends with that, is, you know, the big financial institutions basically control, you know, a lot of power, you know, all around. The banks do. And it's a great book, has a lot of information. And you're right, Bob, a lot of people could see it easily as conspiracy type of things, but I didn't see it like that at all when I was reading it, and I think Quigley was you know, absolutely right about a lot of it.
And of course, as people point out in this area, why is it all of a sudden like a smear term to say something's a conspiracy theory? You know, like the official story of what happened on 9/11 is a conspiracy theory. They're saying these 19 guys conspired to commit, you know, but it's funny just how that phrase all of a sudden shuts down debate. It's like, oh, you think that some people actually plot things in secret? And I was like, well, yeah, that's what everybody thinks. So it's just, you know, something that's particularly out there and, you know, oh, that's disreputable. I guess I'll just mention last thing I want to say on this topic is this really did, because when I was younger, you know, I was into free market economics. As I said, by the time a senior in high school, I was reading Human Action. I'm not saying I fully absorbed and understood it, but I did read Human Action cover to cover as a senior in high school. But I was still pretty naive in the sense that I thought, for example, that the reason we had a federal minimum wage was that all of the Congress people involved with those decisions just really didn't know. That some economists had made the case that raising the minimum wage hurts poor people. And so, of course, now I realize, no, they know that full well, and it's because it helps labor unions. If you price out unskilled labor, you know, you make it so they can't undercut you and so forth. And there's also the pattern, you can study history and you see that how the government tends to grow over time. And before getting into this stuff, I didn't really have a good theory for that. Like if it was just every administration was brand new, a blank slate, and they would come in and they were in, you know, your administration was 4 years. And if you got reelected, it was 8 years total. And that was it. It was like, well, why would they do things that sort of set a precedent? You know, like civil libertarians would say, oh, this measure right now might not seem like a big deal, but, you know, 20 years from now, this is going to have built up and the government at that point is going to be really powerful and be able to control. You know, you hear that and that's just common nature, or so that's just common knowledge among civil libertarians now to talk like that. But it was kind of like, well, why would some, you know, administration put a policy in place if they weren't going to be around to benefit from it. You know, if you weren't going to be the president anymore when this thing actually finally paid off in terms of giving the government power. But what made a lot more sense was when, you know, reading stuff like your articles, Carl's, but also I was reading other things in this area talking about, well, if you were a really rich, you know, you were a billionaire back in the early progressive era, then, you know, maybe you would want to have an income tax put in place because that would keep your competitors down. You know, it'd make it harder for other families to build fortunes and compete with your grandkids that you were prepping to take over the family business and stuff. So it's once you get away from this idea that all the people in the government are just there because of the will of the people, and you start realizing, no, there's some entities that, you know, if you want to call it the private sector or the quasi-private government, who knows, but these real powerful players that could influence things behind the scenes, then all of a sudden the history of government power makes more sense. That, you know, if you realize, well, no, powerful groups, next generation will be able to take advantage of that machinery of the state that's grown over time, that's accumulated. Whether it's true or not, I'm just saying that story makes a lot more sense than that, you know, somebody that George W. Bush on his own just wanted to put the TSA in there because, you know, right. Like, but if he was part of a broader group that was making long-term decisions, and maybe, and I think you're right too, when you try to understand this stuff, you can see how somebody who looks at like how civilized the UK is or the United States and just thinks, if the rest of the world would just listen to us and follow our way of life, look at how peaceful and prosperous we would be. And you could see how in your mind, if you thought, if we have to, you know, take out a few leaders here and there or start some wars here, but if we could just get all the globe under this one system, look at how nice it would be for everybody. So I could see how somebody, if you started getting to that level and looking at people as like pawns on the chessboard, that might mess with you. And especially if you had unimaginable amounts of power, that could totally mess, you know, corrupt you, and you could end up doing things. I'm just saying the world made a lot more sense. You start thinking of it like that. Now, again, the problem is once you go down that path and you start seeing things and making connections and, oh, it all fits, there's a danger. You start making connections that are spurious, and you can, you know, if you let your imagination run, you can do all sorts of stuff. But it made a lot more sense than just, gee, Ted Kennedy just never had an economist give him some advice before, and that's why he's voting for all of these crazy policies.
Now, if you read The City of God, you know, Augustine gives you a view that more or less tells you who runs the world. It's his view of who runs the world. And if you read that book, you come out thinking that much of what Quigley wrote kind of is true. It's the way the world is. And, you know, of course, in Augustine's point of view, you know, he has a completely different take on it, but it's kind of along the same lines. He tells you, you know, you've got two kingdoms that are being built right alongside each other. And so you get that story. And one of them, of course, is the City of God, and gives you a glimpse of what that looks like. And then he tells you about the other kingdom, and gives you an idea of what that looks like. And you know what? It looks a whole lot like the story that Quigley tells.
Well, I'm glad you made that transition, because I was planning to do that too, that ultimately this stuff shouldn't be shocking. I mean, so for the listeners, you know, Carlos, you and I are both Bible-believing Christians. And so, you know, the Bible quite clearly says, I mean, Jesus refers to the devil as the prince of this world. And, you know, when Satan tempts Jesus, you know, he's showing him the kingdoms and say, you know, these will all be yours if you bow down and follow me. So there is, I mean, this is quite biblical to say there's a sense in which obviously God's sovereign. He allows these things to unfold according to his own plan. But there is a sense in which we're living in a fallen world right now. And yeah, there is a conspiracy. If you're a Christian and you have that worldview, yeah, there are malevolent forces at work. And this isn't just a result of honest mistakes. And there could be people implementing truly evil, nefarious plots, and they might be unaware of it. They may have been tricked into thinking that they're doing, you know, something that's good, all things considered. I mean, that's, if you believe in the devil, that's one of the ways he works. He might trick you into thinking, oh yeah, the ends justify the means. So you're doing something that, you know, as a little kid, you would know is immoral, but don't worry. Now you're a grown up and you see that sometimes you gotta, you know, do some things that the normal person would be too squeamish to do, but you know, you have the the true duty, and you have the courage to go ahead and make the tough decisions. I think that's how a lot of these guys, I mean, imagine, you know, giving the order to drop the atomic bomb. You know, like that's that must have been a sobering decision. But you're thinking, well, you know, I'm going to save lives. And, we certainly have to show the Soviets, you know, this new weapon we have. So in the post-war era, they back off of us and don't, you know, we got to. So, again, power corrupts. And but as you say, if you're a Bible believing Christian, the idea that there's nefarious actors at work influencing world events, that's not some crazy theory. That's straight from the Bible.
Yeah. And you come to expect it. You know that because, as you said, God being sovereign, he allows evil to exist, you know, for his purposes. And you're right. He actually has given dominion, you know, to Satan over the world. So what we're trying to differentiate here, you've got the truth and then you've got the lie. And, you know, it's just you have to make a decision which, you know, which side are you on? You know, you have to think that out. Now, a lot of people that are Christians like us, Bob, they should at least know this, that they expect the world to be evil and know that it is because Scripture says that it is. Not only is the world evil, but we ourselves in our fallen state are evil until we're taken out of that condition. I only bring it up only because, you know, we can read all kinds of books to try to get at who runs the world, you know, and Quigley is certainly one of them. It's somebody wants to tackle a 1,000-page book. And The City of God is another one. And we're still grappling with that, you know, that same question, you know.
And it's funny. I was just doing a podcast interview the other day with this young guy. And at the end, he goes, "Oh, thanks so much, Dr. Murphy." And I asked this of all my guests, if you could, you know, for the listeners out there who liked your interview with me, and if you could just tell them to read one book, and you can't pick your own books, if you could just tell them to read one book, what would it be? And at first I was like, you know, scrambling. And then I was like, I would tell them to read the Bible, you know? So, I mean, it was just this epiphany occurred to me, like, well, yeah. And it's funny how, like, you know, you feel squeamish, go, oh, gee. And it was like, well, no, he asked me a question, I'm giving him my answer, and that's the right answer. So yeah, ultimately, if someone wants to know who runs the world, well, I got a book for you. It's called the Bible. Yeah. Yeah. That's where you're going to find it. So I suppose that's probably as good a spot as any to wrap up. So I want to thank you for your generous time with us today, Carlos. And
that's my pleasure.
Folks can, I'll have links, of course, in the show notes page for this episode, folks, but really, all of this stuff, the collaboration that Carlos and I have done on Austrian economics and IBC, that's all over at our website, laramurphy.com. So that's LARA-Murphy.com is where you'll find all that stuff. And Carlos, keep fighting the good fight, and maybe we'll have you back on down the road to tell some more stories.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.